Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. Today, I'll be discussing rising food prices, gun deaths, and more. And after the break, we'll be talking with housing activists Manon Vergerio and Velvet Ross. I want to begin with comments from World Bank President David Malpass. He says we may be seeing food prices rising 37%, and that will be devastating for the world's poor. He says it could push, and now I'm quoting, hundreds of millions into poverty, worsen nutrition, and force millions of children out of school. What's going on here? And he says, in an important aside, this is even worse in terms of its unfairness than the COVID epidemic was. Think about that. Let me explain. About 60% of the poorest countries in the world have already borrowed money to get through the pandemic, and they have to pay that money back. But of course, food prices come first because people have to eat to live. So as food prices go up, these countries, many of whom import parts of their food or all of it, import fuel and other items that have soared up in price. So whatever amount of scarce foreign exchange they have in their country has to go to pay for the food and the fuel without which daily life would come to an end. That leaves them with no money to pay back their debts. And that is going to cut their ability to function. They won't be able to pay their debts. If they try to pay their debts, it'll have to come out of the school budgets and road budgets and health budgets. You can see the kind of catastrophe that's unfolding here. But I want to analyze what the issue is here. The issue is not the war in Ukraine. Doesn't account for this. It's more the sanctions that have been imposed on Russia and Russia's allies that are disrupting global markets, including food and fuel markets, in ways that drive up prices. But maybe the most fundamental lesson to take from this is that the real culprit here is the market. Why? Well, if we have a shortage because of the war, because of the sanctions, even more, if we have a shortage of fuel and food, then the rational, humane way to deal with it is to have a mechanism to distribute it where it's most needed, to distribute it equally, fairly. Every one of us needs food and fuel. It's not something that we can divide up rationally or humanely any other way. But the market doesn't do that. Here's what happens in markets. The people who have the fuel and the food can take advantage of the scarcity to drive up the prices and make more money. And the vast majority of the people who don't have enough money can't afford to pay the higher prices for the food and the fuel. If the market runs the system, a few people become very wealthy when there's scarcity, and a large number of people are forced to do without. The reality is that the market distributes in a fundamentally unjust way and an inhumane way. The market is the problem here, not the scarcity. My next update has to do with something Karl Marx taught us about. Early on in the first volume of Capital, he has a long discussion of the length of the working day. And in that, he says, and remember this is written back in the middle of the 19th century, he says that in capitalism, there's an endless struggle between the employer and the employee. The employer wants the employee to work for the longest number of hours possible for the lowest pay that the employer can get away with giving out as a wage. The employer is always pressing down the wage or lengthening the working day or both. If you know something about the history of capitalism everywhere in the world, it is always this. When it first comes to a country or a region, the working day is 14, 16 hours long. Struggle, usually lasting decades, is needed by working people to reduce the length of the working day. Down to what's the convention in the world today? 40 hours a week, 8 hours each of 5 days. But it took a long time to get it down to that. But the struggle never stops. That was Marx's point. And so here's what happened. Very quickly, employers responded, okay, if the working day is 8 hours, let me tell you, John, the employee, we need you to stick around for an extra half hour. And believe me, you better do as we ask you to. Otherwise, you know, we might have to let you go for somebody who won't object if we tell them, hey, we need you today or maybe even tomorrow for an extra half hour, an extra hour or something. Well, to make a long story short, that was done until workers pushed back. And in the Great Depression in 1938, to be precise, they passed the Fair Labor Standards Act under President Roosevelt. And that specified something interesting. You cannot make a worker work beyond 40 hours. And if you can get the worker to agree to work beyond 40 hours, you must pay that worker time and a half, 50% more for every hour after 40 compared to whatever the going rate is for the first 40. And you know, that had a lot to do with creating the so-called middle class in the United States in the aftermath of the Great Depression. Workers who were required to work longer had to be paid time and a half. And you know, there were two ideas behind that. Not only do you pay workers more if you ask more of them, but there's a bit of a penalty for the employer, right? If you're going to hire a worker and make him or her work beyond 40, you're going to pay 50% more than if you don't do that and hire another worker. In other words, time and a half doesn't only help the worker who does overtime, but it creates more jobs as employers prefer often to hire someone at regular pay rather than make someone work overtime at regular pay plus 50%. But then, of course, the employers never gave up, just like Marx told us. So starting already in the post-war period, they began to say, well, there should be some exemptions. Some workers do specialized work, administrative work, executive work, professional work, and they shouldn't be, because we need them extra. And this was one. The business community got together, bought enough Republicans and Democrats, mostly for sale most of the time, and got the law changed to the point where today, more than half of full-time workers in this country work more than 40 hours and don't get paid, most of them, time and a half, because they use the exemptions as they've been worked out over the years. There's a wonderful article by one of those capitalists who is not afraid of talking about how the system really works, Nick Hanauer by name. In Time magazine of April 21, he talks about the scandal of the overtime struggle. And you know, here's an irony you ought to think about. The Department of Labor could change the rules. It's only a matter of the rules. You don't need the Congress. You don't need the Senate. Mr. Biden could tomorrow reinstate time and a half for everybody over 40, no matter what work he or she does. That would be reasonable, a good program to create better jobs, a good program to pay workers what they ought to be paid if they work extra. But Mr. Biden and his Labor Department aren't even talking about it, let alone doing it. So the struggle, it's called the class struggle. That's what Marx called it. Sounds like a good idea. That class struggle never stops. Pay as little as possible. Get as many hours out of those workers as you can squeeze. Not the health of the worker, mental or physical. Not the well-being of the communities those workers are part of. That's not the issue. It's squeezing the extra profit. That's the name of the game. That's how the system works. I was struck by a gun statistic. You know, we get them from time to time, but every now and then they jump, and I have to talk to you about it. The latest year for which we have complete statistics, 2020. Here were the number of people who died from gun violence. 45,222. That's the federal government count. The overwhelming bulk of those were homicides, not suicides. Among young people between the ages of 1 and 19, more now die from guns than from automobile accidents, which used to be the number one. In fact, I want to tell you about the number one, two, and three killers of young people in the United States between 1 and 19 years of age. Number one, guns. Number two, automobiles. Number three, opioid overdoses. And I want to drive a point home with you. Every one of those is preventable. We could do much more to prevent opioid overdoses, right? By controlling the pharmaceutical companies whose profits drove the distribution of these kinds of painkillers on a scale that the whole world looks at with shock and awe. Just like profit drives our transportation system. So instead of having first-class buses and trolleys and jitneys to move people around, we have the private automobile. That's much more profitable. That's why we're replacing diesel and oil-driven private vehicles with electric private vehicles. What we need, for example, to save the lives of our young people, is a quality public transportation system. But we don't get it because profit-making auto companies prevent it. And now guns. And why are they everywhere? Because the gun industry, with their well-paid ally, the NRA, are constantly doing whatever is necessary to block and prevent a restricted availability of the number one killer of young people in our society. Again, the problem isn't the gun or the opioid drug or the automobile even, but it's a profit-driven system that imposes on us something we should never have allowed in the first place. We've come to the end of the first part of today's show. And as we at Democracy at Work continue celebrating our 10th anniversary, we want to help move closer to a more equitable and democratic world. I want to invite and encourage all of you to explore the variety of other shows, podcasts, and books we produce, like Cities After, a show about the future of cities hosted by Miguel Robles Duran, whose aim is to spark civic imagination into action. You can find his show and others, as well as how to get involved with all of the work we do, by going to our website, democracyatwork.info. And of course, we couldn't do all this without your support and encouragement, which we appreciate greatly. Please stay with us. We'll be right back with Manon Vergerio and Velvet Ross. Welcome back, friends, to the second half of today's economic update. I am both proud and pleased to bring to our microphones and our cameras two remarkable housing activists. Housing is a fundamental right of human beings, and it is a right under attack and in danger in our society, as are so many other fundamental rights. And these two people are fighting in a way that all of us should applaud. The first is Manon Vergerio. She is an organizer and researcher on housing issues in New York, San Francisco, and Paris, her hometown. In her view, victims of urban injustice are expert problem solvers equipped to imagine and design creative solutions. Alongside someone who works with her and who has been busy on her own right is Fannie Lou Diane. She's an activist, artist, women's historian, and writer. She has an MA from Sarah Lawrence College in Women's History and a BA from Brooklyn College in Communications. Evicted and homeless, she became committed to fighting housing discrimination and poverty. This brought her a leadership position in New York City and New York State social movements. So first of all, to both of you, welcome to Economic Update.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
Well, you're doing all of us a service and a favor. Let me begin with either of you to start. Tell us what you think, in your experience, is the problem of homelessness or the condition of the homeless in this country at this time. Manon, you want to start?
Sure, I can kick us off. Or Velva, did you want to start this one?
Yeah, you can go ahead, Manon.
Great. Well, I think it's important to start with some numbers. So today there are over 500,000 Americans who are unhoused. And I think far too often, people think of homelessness as, oh, that's that person's problem. Like they must have had some sort of issue, been an addict or something. But when we look at the numbers, it's really clear that homelessness is a structural problem. It's a product of our housing crisis. So it makes sense that, you know, in cities where real estate is really expensive, like New York City, Los Angeles, San Francisco, staggering numbers of folks who cannot find a home today. You know, since we're in New York, I also want to talk a little bit about the context here. New York City is very particular because we have a right to shelter. The right to shelter was won through a class action lawsuit at the end of the 70s that was led by a group of unhoused men. And while it's really powerful, it also means that sometimes it invisibilizes or misrepresents homelessness, because folks usually think of homelessness as only street homelessness, and we don't really think about the 50,000 people that are in the New York City shelter system. And many of these are families, kids, and then when you add to that folks who are, you know, who've been evicted and are living doubled up with family or doubled up, you know, living in their cars, the numbers are actually super undercounted. And then one last thing, you know, to note about kind of the current state of homelessness in New York City is that because there is the city has a mandate to provide shelter to its population, there's this whole ecosystem of organizations, private companies that build and operate shelters, and it's in their interest to keep the shelters full. And that's what many homeless leaders and advocates call the shelter industrial complex.
Mm-hmm. And just to add on to what Manon said, we have to also realize that, like she said, New York is very specific in terms of how it houses its homelessness, but that's only New York City and not New York State and the rest of the country. And so prior to the pandemic, we were already on the brink of a homeless crisis. HUD states that 580,000 people in the United States were homeless. And already in New York City, we were already having a burden of cost in terms of housing, because 30% of people pay at least 50% of their paycheck towards their housing costs. And so it doesn't leave much for many people to have anything more. And then with the sheltering in during COVID, it exacerbated those rates, leading many people to become homeless, especially those who were single. We saw during COVID, we saw the most amount of single people homeless, 92,000 single people who were homeless. Fortunately, during that time when people were mandated to stay in the house, there were some programs that were able to save some families, but not all families were eligible for many of the vouchers that the state and federal government were able to give them. So this crisis was prior to before COVID, but also is being exacerbated more now with the lack of affordability and the lack of options for affordable housing.
You know, there was a terrible irony that was noted that we were telling people during the pandemic and even to the present you know, wash your hands all the time, stay indoors, keeps, you know, and the mockery of the homelessness, telling them that the only way to be safe was to do something they obviously couldn't do, it was a kind of torture that struck many of us watching. I want to get to the sort of deeper issue. Housing has been a problem. You can find people talking about homelessness in the 18th century, the 19th century, the 20th century. Here we are in the 21st century. What in the world is going on? Why is this problem not solved? Why are we in this situation? And I turn to you because I know you've done research as well as been activists. Help us understand what this system is failing at, that it cannot deal with this.
Well, there are two, well, for me, there are two different issues. First of all, people make money off of people being homeless. You know, it costs more money to shelter someone in a shelter at night than to give them an apartment. The city usually pays $3,000 a night for someone to stay in the shelter. And so it would be easier for them to get a voucher and for them to find a place to live, but it's not coming off as easy because of the fact that people are making money off of people being homeless. It's a money grabbing process. You know, these shelters make money and those people are counted as money for them. And so that's one of the issues why homelessness is still deeply embedded in our society, and it really won't go away until people stop profiting off of it.
Wow.
And I think, you know, when I think about the root causes of our housing crisis, I think it really comes down to the fact that land and housing have been commodified. And if you could trace this back all the way to settler colonialism, European colonizers coming to this land and stealing land from indigenous communities and imposing a private property system that had very rigid lines around who could own land and who couldn't. So, you know, we only have 15 minutes today, so we don't have time to talk about the entire history, but, you know, you fast forward 400 years and today this commodification of land and housing has accelerated into this hyper financialization of housing. So homes are being treated as these speculative investment vehicles. So now we have, you know, private equity firms like Blackstone that own hundreds of thousands of housing units across the globe, and they're accountable to their shareholders, right? They're not accountable to their tenants. Their priority isn't the safety and well-being of their tenants. It's profit margins. So they'll do anything they can to really drive up rents, to optimize their portfolios. And what that looks like for tenants is evictions, ever increasing rents. In New York City, we've seen how predatory equity has led to a ton of displacement. So that's when a corporation comes in, buys a rent stabilized building, and then harasses, evicts the tenants, and then, you know, deregulates the building and turns it into market rate apartments. So you take that and then add the entire layer of living in a white supremacist society and how the racist policies that have shaped this country have really shaped also the housing market and who has access to housing and who doesn't.
And on top of that, you have to also look at the fact that when Manon said white supremacy, housing injustice is related to white supremacy and is a racial justice issue. If you think about how many people are homeless, and 39% of the population of people who are homeless are Black, but we're only 13% of the population. And a lot of that has a lot to do with the systemic rules and laws that were put in place by this government to deny Black people housing. And so when you look at those rates and you see that, you see this is a systemic issue that has going back towards slavery. And so something like that is not going to be rooted out overnight because it's so rooted and embedded in our country's fabric.
There's a lot of talk these days that we're about to suffer a tsunami of evictions, that somehow the combination of real estate investment, the way Manon just mentioned it, rising prices everywhere, money to be made by real estate, that it becomes desirable for the speculators and the investors to evict as many people as they can in order to, you know, prettify the apartment and raise the rent. Are we about to have an eviction catastrophe that makes homelessness even a larger problem than you're already telling us?
Well, we already are having an eviction crisis right now. Currently, you have more evictions that are happening more before the pandemic. And so now, with the right to remain counsel that people can now get attorneys, it's gotten so bad that there aren't even enough attorneys available for people to have representation in court. And so, you know, people always say evictions hurt small mom and pop landlords, but that's not really true. It's basically these wealthy real estate developers who benefit from all of this. And so right now, because of the fact that we did not extend the moratorium, we are in a crisis right now. Thousands of people are being evicted as we speak right now.
And obviously, a society that was committed to this problem could easily hire the lawyers that would make it possible, at least for those threatened with eviction, to get the maximum legal support that they're entitled to under the law. In the time we have left, could I ask the two of you, based on your own experience, what would you do? What kind of solution would you ask us to be thinking about, and would you be organizing to achieve?
Yeah, so I think one thing we've learned from like the 30 or so years of neoliberal housing policymaking is that relying on the private sector to build affordable housing just doesn't work. So, you know, New York City has tried all sorts of things like giving tax breaks to developers, rezoning entire neighborhoods to, you know, sweeten the deal and tell developers like, oh, if you build, you know, this giant tower in a working class neighborhood, you'll have to include some sort of affordable housing percentage in it. But what happens is that none of the units created are actually affordable to the people who need them. So I would advocate for, you know, we need to take land out of the speculative market. So I'm really excited about models like community land trust, which, you know, again, you know, take land out of the speculation and put it under a legal structure that's community controlled at the community level, and to make sure that the land stays affordable in perpetuity. I'm also really excited by, you know, and inspired by movements abroad. Like Berlin last year held a referendum and the majority of the city voted for corporate landlords who were destabilizing the markets to be expropriated and for their properties to come back under public ownership. So I think, you know, this country has used eminent domain many times to sometimes tear apart Black communities. And I think eminent domain could be used in a very different way and bring some of these units that are being speculated on back under public or community controlled ownership.
And I will add on to that, what we're doing at Unlock is we're also trying to stem the tide of people who are being discriminated for having vouchers. That's one part of the work that we are doing to kind of stem the tide here in New York City. Also in New York State with Housing Justice for All, we are looking to get past good cause evictions, which would benefit 1.6 million renters household in New York State from being evicted for retaliating against their landlord for different conditions that are really bad. Another thing is extending rights to counsel, not just to New York City, but also to the rest of the state. So the rest of the state can have someone represent them in court. And a lot of times they find that those who are evicted usually don't have representation in court. And so those are some of the things that we are working on. They're small, but they will have a larger context and be and beneficial to generations after that, after to come.
Okay. I apologize that we only have the time that we did, but you have enlightened us in enormously important ways about a problem that is about to get worse and that is already a kind of blot on this system. So more power to you. Thank you for the work that you do, and thank you for the time you've given to share what you have to say.
Thank you so much for having us today.
Thank you for having us.
You're very welcome. And to my own audience, thank you very much for joining us today, and I look forward, as always, to speaking with you again next week.